Thank you very much. And it's a real pleasure to be here. And this talk is from a paper that was written by Danielle Clarkson. And she worked with data from one of our monitoring studies. And so since I live here and she couldn't come to Atlanta, I told her I would be happy to do this talk. The whole idea was to take a look at a data set we have of women in a monitoring program designed to look at women entering prenatal care and then cord blood at delivery to get trends in organic contaminant exposure over a period of several years. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. So the little red dot you see is the community of Bethel, which is the hub for the Yukon-Kuskokwim River Delta. That river runs from just to the upper left of the red dot back into the interior, and the Kuskokwim starts at that bay that's just there, a quarter of an inch from Bethel, and runs up into the interior, and they form the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. These are Yupik, Alaska natives, and the women are all prenatal patients from that region. There were 568 of them at the time Danielle did her analysis. They're enrolled at the first prenatal visit, and they have blood and urine. Medical records are reviewed after they deliver, and the infant cord blood is gathered at deliver if the delivery room nurse remembers it. And then their medical records are reviewed at a year of age. So in addition to a large panel of industrial and agricultural organic contaminants, mostly organochlorines, which almost all of you are familiar with, we began about halfway through the monitoring program to measure the fluorinated compounds. All these analyses were done at CDC's Division of Laboratory Science in Laboratory Services in Atlanta, and that's where the data was created, and they've done that throughout this study. So all these analyses were done in the same place by the same methods. So the PFAS compounds were first synthesized in the 40s. They're widely used, and they've been widely disseminated by oceanic and atmospheric transport mechanisms. They do bioaccumulate in the food chain, and they're commonly found in water from industrial sources in the U.S., and that's where they're often, most often, an object of real concern. And there's an uncertain yet association with human health effects from the exposure to perfluorinated compounds, and it's driven by the interesting fact that these compounds are often seen in their highest levels in people who have high cholesterols. And whether that's a chicken or egg phenomenon is not known, but animal data suggests that maybe these compounds are capable of increasing cholesterol synthesis. Because cholesterol in humans, at least when you measure it in the blood, is mostly endogenously produced. It's not from being consumed. And on the other hand, the perfluorinated compounds are entirely exogenous. And so the question is, do the higher compounds cause the production of more cholesterol, or does a higher cholesterol level mean that these compounds are metabolized and synthesized less rapidly? And the answer to that isn't known. So total cholesterol, almost all of you are familiar with So the cholesterol in humans is a marker for various kinds of disease states. It's not necessarily required for them, but it's definitely associated with them. And so it's a concern that we thought merited looking at in pregnancy. And the objectives of the study were to describe the exposure of the women in this monitoring cohort and look at their total cholesterol levels in the maternal organic monitoring study cohort over time, and to determine if those total cholesterol levels were in any way associated with exposure to the perfluorinated compounds. So of the 586 women who were available for analysis, who had records available for analysis, about 325 actually had both perfluorinated compounds and cholesterol data. And of that group, the weeks of pregnancy at the time of blood draw was accurately ascertainable in 283, and that turned out to be the cohort of interest. Just a word about the monitoring system. All the Arctic countries have maternal monitoring programs. In the U.S., it's this one here, and all the other Arctic countries select women from those presenting in labor at small rural hospitals, and their blood's drawn on admission to the delivery room, and they're cord blood right after that. We didn't do that because we were interested in the incidence of morbidity in early pregnancy that might be related to these compounds, and you miss all that if you only look at the cohort that delivers. So we look at the cohort as they enroll. Now, they don't all enroll in the first trimester. We have a group in this particular study that decided at the last minute they wanted to be part of this study, and so they were enrolled because it's all voluntary, and you'll see that as we move a little later on. The analytes here were measured by the methods you see there, and that's a list of the ones that were there in large enough number of women above the level of detection that they could be analyzed statistically, as that's the standard that's used around the circumpolar north. And so they're going to be looked at in the ways here that you see in the second bullet. And, oops, so this describes the selection criteria and the statistical method. And the fact that they had total cholesterols was not because we were interested in their cholesterols. It was a matter that was determined by the fact that most of these analytes are expressed in micrograms per kilo of lipid. So they're not micrograms per milliliter of blood or liter of blood. Instead, they're expressed in terms that are related to the lipid content of the blood, and which is a little strange to me, but that's the way they do it. These aren't necessarily stored in lipid. They're transported bound to protein, different than the other organic analytes. So these women were relatively young. Their mean total cholesterol was 218.7 milligrams per deciliter, and there's the range. The cholesterol in humans generally rises throughout pregnancy. All lipid levels rise throughout pregnancy, and that's part of human pregnancy. Red cell mass rises, total blood volume rises, and so do lipids. So the trimester of blood draw is shown there, and about a fourth of them had their blood drawn in the first trimester, which is when we'd like it. Early in the second trimester is actually when at least a third of them had their blood drawn, and a significant proportion had their blood drawn in the third trimester, usually fairly close to delivery, while they were boarding for delivery in Bethel. So age-wise, this is a pretty typical description of the age distribution in our maternal cohort. It doesn't differ at all from the 568 that we've looked at in this same way. And there's a significant number that are over 26 and a significant number that are under 26, and there's the trimester of age that they were sampled in. So the association of age and trimester on total cholesterol shows exactly what you'd expect, and these women are good examples of that. In fact, the later the sample's taken, the higher the cholesterol at significant levels. And it's true if you look at it by age and by trimester. The older women tended to show up later for enrollment, and so those women tend to have higher cholesterols because they're usually what we've seen is it rises with age as well. So here are the descriptive statistics and the values, blood levels here. These are levels that are not, at least the top four compounds there, are not too different than the NHANES women, the few NHANES women we looked at to compare it with. However, the three bottom, they're not congeners, variant perfluorinated compounds are not ones that we see in measurable amounts in nearly as enough women to show up in the all races in Haynes data. So that's a difference. And the difference is probably related to the source. Most lower 48 women who live in the continental United States get their perfluorinated compounds from either drinking water, which is pretty common. That's a good way to, not a good way. It's a common way to acquire it. And in food. And the food is usually locally raised, or at least raised somewhere in the continental U.S. So it reflects that same distribution. In Alaska, these women are subsistence consumers. And the base of the food chain from a consistent standpoint in the YK Delta is the Pacific salmon. And when you look, as we have in this same study, at the salmon and their perfluorinated compounds, they have these less common variants. And so that's where these come from. This is a subsistence food acquired analyte. So these are a series of comparisons and statistical analyses looking at whether any particular compound in the column on the left is found to vary significantly throughout pregnancy. And in fact, they do, and you can see that they do. Almost all of them do. And with the regression model that was used, it essentially bears this out. So, in summary, there are some significant differences between these two congeners, PFNA and PFDEA, by age group, and there are significant differences in the mean values of these things by trimester. So all the perfluorinated compounds, almost all of them, vary by trimester, and the ones that are in the second bullet there are very significantly associated with cholesterol and both increase during pregnancy. The trend in total perfluorinated compounds in our pregnant population shows that the total is lower in the later cohorts, and that fits with the U.S. data. It's slowly decreasing, and as chlorinated compounds that are different than the ones we've got circulating here are introduced, they tend to be less persistent, and their levels, we don't have trends for those yet, just because they've been introduced in the last 5 or 6 years, and they don't have the same half-life. So the trend is lower, which is good. In UPIC women, this is acquired from the salmon. It's part of the subsistence food chain. And like any other group of women, it increases. They increase with duration of pregnancy and with total cholesterol. And we have enough confounding factors in the study that it's hard to say, impossible to say, whether the cholesterol is in any way related to a cause for, or is caused by the fluorinated compounds. It just, you just can't say from this data, but they follow the same pattern as other pregnant women do with respect to cholesterol increase. And in respect to pregnancy, these compounds increase too. They're protein bound, and protein, serum proteins increase in pregnancy as well. So it could be that there's a factor there that we can't compensate for or even appreciate in the data set we have here. But the perfluorinated compounds increase with levels of the same analytes, chlordane, DDT, PCBs. They all increase together or decrease together in the same woman. So they're all acquired from the same place. They have slightly different half-lives, but essentially they're subsistence food acquired in this population. So you can see the sort of conclusions and the problems remaining that really need to be looked at a lot more clearly. And it's one of those things that, as Danielle notes here, the differences may be affected by diet and age. As far as the perfluorinated compounds go, the cholesterol, that's not such a big issue. But definitely the perfluorinated compounds increase with the subsistence food intake, and they bioaccumulate and stay around long enough so that if you have over years always had a higher subsistence food intake and you're not an 18-year-old prima gravida, but you're a 35-year-old gravida 5, then you're going to have more of this. And that's, in fact, what we found. Oops. So overall, the perfluorinated compound concentrations are decreasing over time, with the exception of this new one here that's been recently introduced. And some of them were significantly associated with total cholesterol after controlling for age or weeks of pregnancy. And as usual, in almost everything, you need more studies and more information, because this was really sort of a target of opportunity with this data set, because we had both cholesterols and perfluorinated compounds for a portion of this cohort. So I'd like to thank the folks at CDC, and there they are, the EPA funded the MOMS study monitoring grants from 99 right through 2015. So we couldn't have done it without that. And during the early parts of these studies, the grants were, or the, all the analytes were done free by CDC. We were able to pay them for this last group. So, as always, we're indebted to the women and medical providers at the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. And I think I'll quit there. And is there time for questions? Two questions. Nope. Well, I have a whole talk on that. Yeah, the question is, where do these contaminants come from? Are you talking about just the perfluorinated compounds? Yeah, okay, that's a little easier. They come from the seawater, and in the seawater component, it's the North Pacific that is the donor for all the Bering Sea seawater, with exception of the river input. And it's not coming from the river input. This is industrial, and it leaches out of landfills. It's a part of consumer products that are thrown away. And the major current in the Bering Sea is up the west side across just south of the Aleutian chain. and then through the passes into the Aleutian Islands. So a lot of it, perhaps most of it, is picked up by the big Asian river inflow into the western boundary current of the Pacific. A significant part of it could be coming from the U.S., and we don't know, though, how to separate that out. Yeah, we don't find it in our drinking water in the Delta. There are some contaminated wells in the Fairbanks region, but this is 1,000 miles from there. Yes, sir.
I have a pretty loud voice, but I'll use the microphone anyway. I'm from New Hampshire. We actually have a PFC or PFAS problem in New Hampshire with drinking water contamination. I know that this is sort of a separate issue because there was no known, you know, contamination or exposure other than just, you know, routine exposure through through everyday environment and food and subsistence farming. I'm wondering if you're doing additional work with PFCs, and if you're doing additional health study, because I appreciate your very balanced talk on PFCs. As you know, the long-term health implications are still unclear and a little bit controversial. I'm wondering if you're using this as an opportunity to pursue further health investigation, or whether this was a one-time study because of the availability of data.
Yeah, that's a good question. It turns out that everything in the north, when you study monitoring data, is an exercise in mixture toxicology. There's no pure exposure study. And so what you're limited to is a within, and the way we all do it in every country is a within cohort comparison of health effects, health outcomes, those that are there in sufficient quantities to analyze, and the quartile or quintile of exposure to that compound or group of compounds. And often, you know, you hear studies from the north talking about PCB, but in fact, it's never pure PCB. It's PCB with half a dozen other bad actors. And so it's a very long process, especially with a sparse population, to separate out what exposures are associated with adverse effects on, say, a developing fetus or a mother, as opposed to those that are caused by lifestyle issues like smoking, for instance, which is very common in the Alaska Native population. And anemia is endemic. So there are lots of newborn exposure issues. Alcohol is a problem that's less than it was. Alcohol during pregnancy, it's still there. So all of that makes it a long-term effort to separate out what might be a health effect from the group of exposures versus something that's due to lifestyle or something completely different. Yes, we are. Uh-huh.
Jim, thanks. A nice data set. Would you be able to look at liver function indicators by any chance? Some of the limits of exposure set by ATSDR are based on some liver function in part. I'm wondering if you had those data to make these?
No? We don't.
Okay, cool. Thanks.
Can we hold? Yeah, there you go.